Last week, we were in the middle of getting rid of a lot of money to the Queen of Sheba and getting a lot of money and stuff from her as well. And as we were wrapping that up, we mentioned that in verse 11 of chapter 10 of 1 Kings, that these ships of Hiram, and they were the king up from Lebanon, Phoenicia area. She gave all of this gold, which brought gold from Ophir, O-P-H-I-R, and we couldn't figure out where that was, and nobody else did either. And even one of our resident scholars told me afterward that he had Googled it and hunted for it and still can't find it. So I'm in pretty good company to say we don't know where that is. Speculation is that it could be somewhere around India, or it could be as far away as East Africa. But nobody knows. And it's important because if we knew where that was, we'd have an idea of what kind of wood it is that they got from there. He made A-L-M-U-G in some translations, A-L-G-U-M in other translations, wood and precious stones from there. But we know that the king, King Solomon, had his craftsmen, his art people, to build these lions out of this wood, and he had 12 of them on the 6 steps that led up to his throne. And it was also wood that was suitable for making all kinds of musical instruments. So I just was curious to, you know, what kind of wood makes musical instruments? And the first one that came to mind was guitar making. And there's about 6 different kinds of various exotic kind of woods that go into guitars. And so I really didn't pursue it much further than that because I thought there might be a hint. But the only hint anybody came up with is the speculation hint that this might be sandalwood from India. And I don't know what sandalwood looks like, but it's a very expensive wood, and that may be what it was. So, verse 13, King Solomon gave the queen all she wanted. And she had already brought him a whole bunch of stuff and packed up and went home. So the weight of the gold that came to Solomon was 666 talents of gold. I think that's in the neighborhood of maybe about $500 million worth on today's market.
25 tons.
Yeah. Lots of money at $1,200 an ounce and 16 ounces to a pound and 2,000 pounds to a ton. That's a lot of money. But where did he get it from? Not just what you'd think, you know. Besides that, 15, he got it from the traveling merchants. And he got incomes from the traders. And from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. Now, the governors were kind of like our governors, maybe. They had little territories within the whole kingdom that they were in charge of, and they collected the taxes. Now, we're going to find out, if we get there, that Jeroboam and Rehoboam have this little face-off. And Rehoboam says, if you think Solomon was hard, you ain't seen nothing yet. So Solomon was hard, and this is proof of it here, is how he collected a lot of money. 16, King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went in each shield. Well, that's a pretty expensive shield, especially if you're going to take it out to fight anybody with, because gold is not a very hard metal. I don't think it would do the job, so it's all for show. Then they had 300 of little ones. You know, the big ones were just almost like total body length. The little ones were what you'd hold up, you know, if you're just in a kind of a dagger fight or whatever, you know. But those he put and kept them on display in this house of the forest of Lebanon. Now, what kind of wood do you think the house of the forest of Lebanon was made out of mostly?
Cedar.
Expensive cedar. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. Now, where do you think he's going to get that ivory? From the elephant's tusk. More than likely, African elephants. I don't know if Indian elephants put out that much, you know, ivory in their little tusks or not, but definitely an expensive thing. And there's a unique thing about ivory. Some 200 or 300 years later, not sure how many years it was, a fellow by the name of Ahab had a nice little lady he ran around with named Jezebel. But Ahab, according to the scriptures, had a whole bunch of ivory. And all of the skeptics said he didn't have any ivory because we hadn't found any. Well, not too many years ago, they found a bunch of ivory in his ruins where he had been, proving the Bible was true after all, when all these years, maybe 300 or 400 years of people writing commentaries, you know, saying that's one of the mistakes the Bible made because Ahab didn't have any ivory. Well, he did. So, he made 6 steps and a back to it, and armrests, and lions, and the 12 lions, the 6 steps we mentioned before. All of King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. Now, $1,200 an ounce today for gold. $20 is about the rate, I think it's 18 last I looked, for silver. So it's a multiple of 60 on today's market. He's there saying that the gold was so plentiful that it just, you know, caused the price of silver to go to nothing. It just wasn't worth much. So that's an exaggeration of probably what silver was worth, but that's how it was accounted. The king had merchant ships in 22, and every 3 years they completed their circle, bringing back gold and silver and ivory and apes and monkeys. So they definitely had a run to Africa to get that. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules, at a set rate year by year. That sounds a lot like pay to play to me. Is that kind of what it sounds like? That if you want a presence with King Solomon to hear his wisdom, you better come up with the entrance price, with the access to the king price. Year by year that was set, so that you paid to get in, and that's what kept him even richer and richer and richer and richer. And he gathered chariots and horsemen, 26. And he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king of Jerusalem. Now, as we think about this, do you remember anything at all said to address the building up of your stables of horses in the Bible? Anything at all?
No, no
Just such a tiny little obscure passage in Deuteronomy 17. If you want to look there and look it up, it says three kings, three things that the kings should not do. This is when they're begging, give us a king like everybody else. Well, if you have a king, be sure that he doesn't do this. Don't get a bunch of horses. Don't build up your own bank account with gold and silver. And don't take a whole bunch of wives. Three verses there, right in a row, right in the middle of Deuteronomy 17, warns not to do that. Well, Solomon has done a hat trick. He has got all three of those. And that's why he goes to his death with the sentence placed upon him that this kingdom is going to be torn from you. You won't have to suffer through it, but your son, the new king, is going to have it ripped to pieces. And we have the prophet that will tell him all about that in just a minute as we go through here. But 1,400 chariots, you know, one of the richest men in the world is the Sultan of Brunei. I may not be able to pronounce it right, but that's a little place in Indonesia where he's got wealth approximately $20 billion, right up there with Gates and Buffett, you know, and those guys. He has 6,000 or 7,000 cars that he has. And he's got the biggest collection of cars in the world. Now, some of the other billionaires have a couple hundred cars, you know, something like that. But not anything like what this guy. Imagine, Solomon has got twice that many. You know, and they're probably all sports cars, too. Sports chariots, you know. They're racing chariots, you know. They're not for protection so much, you know. But he's got plenty of other guys and horsemen and stuff. But he wasn't supposed to have that many horses. And he wasn't supposed to have that much gold. And he wasn't supposed to have that many wives. So he made silver as common 27, in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedars as abundant as the sycamores which were in the lowland. Now what do we know about a sycamore? Any idea what a sycamore tree is good for? Other than the... Yeah, Zacchaeus was a wee little man. He climbed up a sycamore tree. And Jesus invited himself to eat lunch with him that day. What is sycamore tree? Well, Amos. Ever hear of Amos? He's about the third or fourth prophet after Isaiah, and although in the Bible anyway. He did his prophesying. He was a prophet in about 750, something like that. About 300 years later than what this is going on. And Amos was called to be a prophet from being a farmer. And what he farmed was sycamore and olive trees. That's his agricultural work. And you can find that in Amos, you know, if you want to read there. But it defined a sycamore tree as an inferior kind of fig. It was inferior because it collected a lot of insects. And Amos devised a method by which he would penetrate the fig before it came to ripeness and let the insects all get out. Now, I can't imagine wanting to eat a fig or a sycamore fruit, you know, that's got insects in it. So, you know, but I guess if you're hungry enough and you have a lot of a desire to make jam or marmalade or whatever that stuff is out of that, maybe it's okay. But sycamores were used as the inferior wood if you didn't have anything else to build your stuff out of, you could use wood out of the sycamore trees because they were very abundant in that region. But they became kind of like the stones and kind of like the silver. They were such a second-class kind of wood compared to the cedar that was so plentiful that they got from King Hiram up in Lebanon. And he imported horses from Egypt and Kevah. Now, there's about 15 different spellings of that. And the only one that I really know is Tarsus. Tarsus. That is the old city that became Tarsus, the place where somebody by the name of Saul came from, who later became Paul, in Cilicia, which is in Turkey. But he got these horses and he'd buy them at the current rate and then sell them to somebody else, all the kings of the Hittites and all the kings of Syria, and make big profits from the horse business. But King Solomon, chapter 11, loved many foreign women as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. He got into some high cotton there when he got her as a wife. As well as the women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. Now remember the Moabites, if you can see them over there, Moab, just east of the Dead Sea. And the Ammonites are just above them, over there in the land of Gad. Gad had to take those away from them. And then we don't have it on the map, but below the Moabites is where the Edomites were. And let's see if there's any other ites here to identify. The Hittites. Anytime you hear ancient Hittite, just think Turkey. Turkey. The country of Turkey, when the Hittite kingdom was at its largest, encompassed almost the entire country of Turkey and spilled over a little bit into its neighbors. And then Syria, at various times, Syria was larger than what it is today, but it's that region that's up there. We can't quite see it there, but it's above, well, if you can read East Manasseh, can you see that, the green one? It'd be across from that. Be across from that and then yet a little bit further north. That's where the Syria of this particular time in history is. Okay. The Sidonians were also up there, but they're on the left, and that's the region of Phoenicia and on up that direction. So you got the wives from the king's daughters, and to get 700 of them, he must have gone on into the vice king and the secretary of horses or whatever, you know, his daughter as well, a bunch of other noblemen to provide that many wives, and all of them led him astray because he was told not to do it. Verse 2, the nations from whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you, for surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He was in love with them. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And in the next little section there, it tells you a little bit about those. And we're supposed to be traveling a lot faster than what we have been, so we'll kind of hit some of this pretty lightly. Because he did this, the Lord got angry with him and had appeared to him, verse 9, appeared to him twice. Well, there's a total of 4 times that God communicated with Solomon. Twice in a dream where he appeared to him like this one, and two other times when he spoke through the mouth of a prophet to tell him what to do. And Solomon didn't follow through very well on any of that. Because you have done this, verse 11, and have not kept my covenant, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nonetheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, will not tear away the whole kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Now we're going to get this great big inconsistency here in a minute. Is the southern kingdom one tribe or two tribes? Is the northern kingdom 10 tribes? Well, let's see if we can sort that out as we read on through here. And we'll have to postpone that question for a little while, because the writer of this, which we decided was Jeremiah, some years later, is writing this. He's got three rabbits to chase, and he chases these rabbits quite a long time. Now, the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite, and he was from the kingdom of Edom. Now, Hadad is an interesting name. It's like Pharaoh. It's like Caesar. It's a royal name, and it's not his real name, but it's what you would call a king. But in their language, King such and such, Hadad such and such. And they keep calling him Hadad the whole time. But he happened to run away and not get killed when Joab, who was, and we got a flashback several years to the kingdom of David. David went over and beat up these guys over there in Edom, and he sent Joab, his commander, to clean it all up and bury all the slain, took him 6 months to do that. And during that time, verse 17, Hadad fled to Egypt, and with his father's servants, a royal party, you know, took him. And they arose from Midian and came to Paran, and they took him there to Egypt. Now, Midian, ring a bell? Who spent 40 years in Midian? A fellow by the name of Moses, didn't he? Yeah, that's where Moses spent 40 years. And he came to Egypt, and the Pharaoh liked him, found great favor, gave him his wife's sister to be his wife. And they say this must have been an important lady, because her name was mentioned, Tahpenes, in verse 19 and 20 and all that. And they had a little boy by the name of Jenubath, and he was such a cute little fella, obviously, because Queen of Egypt says, let's take him in and raise him along with all of our other royal children. So they did. And that's the end of the story. We don't hear anything else about it, because we're doing this flashback chasing these rabbits. Then another adversary was Rezon, R-E-Z-O-N. He was king, he was son of Eliadad, whatever. And he fled from his lord, Hadad Ezer. So this guy's name was Ezer, and they just ran it together. He was King Ezer, Hadad Ezer. And he was from the country of Zobath. Well, where in the world is Zobath? Never heard of it before until I studied up on it. It's the other name, ancient name, for region up there, of just a part of the region of Syria. So it's up there on the other side of Dan, up there, about where the B of tribes is on the map. We don't really have it, but that's where the location of Zobah And this Rezon guy, he rebelled against his king up there. Had a bunch of guys went with him, and they caused all kinds of trouble. And then they decided they'd move over to Damascus, which is more directly north of the Sea of Galilee on up there. You might even be able to see it on some of your maps. And he just kind of adopted that city and ruled it. He didn't expand much further than that, but he took that over and reigned in Damascus. And he was an adversary. He was a thorn in Solomon's flesh all the same time in the north, as much as this guy that went down to Egypt was in the south. And then there was the third one that was in the rabbit chasing, and that's Jeroboam, his servant. Didn't we say just a minute ago that God said, your servant is going to take away your kingdom? That's the one. So he rebelled against the king, but he was rebelling a little bit too early. And so Solomon got wind of it, and he had to escape to Egypt. So he went down to Egypt, and while he was there hiding out, a lot of other things happened. So we fast forward on to the prophet that tells Solomon that it's all over, you know, and I'm going to leave two tribes for your son to rule. But he said one tribe, one place. Well, it's the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. Now, what do we know about the tribe of Benjamin some years ago before this? They got all almost wiped out. There were just a handful of the ladies left, and they had all made a promise not to take them as wives. But they figured out a way to trick a bunch of guys into taking them for wives, or else the Benjamin tribe would be totally gone. If you remember that, it's an interesting little story. We won't go into it any further. But they were absorbed in the tribe of Judah. At one time, the tribe of Benjamin is that little bitty tiny sliver there that included Jerusalem all the way over to Jericho, and just very narrow little band there. But by this time, there was not much, maybe a few hundred left of the Benjamin tribe, and they're absorbed into Judah. So from all practical purposes, it's just one tribe. But it's really the remnants of the Benjamin tribe as well, making it two. So when they say one, some they may say Judah, including Benjamin. If they say two, then they're talking about the same thing, Judah and Benjamin. Okay, now, the death of Solomon, skip all the way down to 41. Now, the rest of the acts of Solomon, all that he did and his wisdom, are they not written in the books of the acts of Solomon? And the period that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. And Solomon rested with his father and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his place. Now, I hesitate to make Solomon out to be different than what he really was. But I have not had much good to say about Solomon. But how could I realistically say Solomon was such a terrible guy when I can read Ecclesiastes and get such great comfort? When I can read the Proverbs and get such wonderful encouragement? So did Solomon have three periods of his life? Or was he about the same all the way through? Okay, if he had three periods of his life, there was that early period when he had the chance to ask God for anything, and he said, give me wisdom. And God said, since you asked for wisdom, I'll give you riches as well. Because he could have asked for riches. And then this terrible time in the middle when he goes after all these foreign gods, and he does all this stuff and gets all the wives and does the violation of the horses and the gold and stuff like that. And then somehow, at the end of his life, he says, the whole duty of man is what? Fear God and keep his commandments. That doesn't sound like the guy we know, does it? So here's the other possibility. Solomon may have been all the time the same, except that he was guilty of what some of us may be guilty of. Do as I say, not as I do. Could he have been writing all this stuff from the wisdom that God gave him and just never pointing his finger back to himself? Or, you know, how's that go? He points a finger at Chuck there. There are three of them coming right back at me. You know, so I deserve being preached at three times as much as anybody else, and many times. That's true. So wrestle with that in your minds. I don't know the answer to that. All I know is Solomon has some of the most comforting words that you'll ever read. And David had a lot of them too in the Psalms. So he died, and now we're going to have and I'm going to try to go through this as fast as I can and just kind of take my word for it. We've got Rehoboam, that's the son of Solomon, that's going to take over. And we got Jeroboam, who gets word from Egypt, where he's hanging out. And there's a Pharaoh by the name of Shishak that's helping him out. And he comes back, and all of this is located right at Shechem, which is in that region now that's called Ephraim. The darker green, kind of in the middle, that's where all the headquarters of the northern kingdom kind of settles out. It's right there at Shechem. That's also the city of Sychar that we read about in John 4, where the lady and Jacob's well is there. We got Ebal on the north side and Gerizim in the south side of a little region there where all this is happening. So Jeroboam gets all the people to like him because of what Rehoboam said to the whole company met. Now, the whole country had representatives there. And that's when he said, if you think Solomon was bad, I'm going to whip you with a whip that has a sharp knife in the end of it, kind of like the scourges. So he whipped you with a regular kind of whip. I'm going to whip you even worse. And because of that, they rebelled, and Rehoboam sent one of his top henchmen, I think he might be called the Secretary of the Treasury, sent him out to give them the word that you guys behave yourself, I'm king and you got to follow me. They rocked him. They stoned him. And then Rehoboam said, I'm going to get on one of these chariots that my dad had and head back to Jerusalem as fast as I can get there. And he thought he would get an army together so they'd go fight, but God told him, don't do it. And he, for once, believed him and didn't. So he could have fought to try to keep the kingdom, but it was God's will that happened, so he did not. And so there you have the story of how the kingdoms got divided. Got the northern kingdom with Jeroboam, and he listens to these young men, his young advisors and does all kinds of bad things. He could have listened to some of the older men that had advised Solomon, but he didn't take their advice, and because of that, he's got all kinds of trouble, and this revolt happens, and Jeroboam has built in Shechem. I'm at verse 25 of chapter 12 now, dwelt there, and he built that up, and then he built up another place. And if you'll go right straight across the Jordan River, you get to Penuel. Do you remember anything about Penuel? Who wrestled an angel at Penuel? Okay. What judge hung out there that also did fleece? Give you a hint. Gideon. Gideon is mentioned as having been in Penuel for a time. So you've got all these interesting little things that happened 200 or 300 years this way or 200 or 300 years that way that keep recycling, as you do these things. And it's interesting for me to find out what all those were. But as you wrap up chapter 12, Jeroboam ordained a feast, 32, on the 15th day of the 8th month. Now, when did the southern kingdom and when did God and all the tribes of Judah and the way God wanted it, when did they have their feast of tabernacles? Remember what month? What week? What? 7th month. 15th day. So he's got to be a little bit different and be the 8th month, the 15th day, and have one just like theirs, except they're going to do it in the Mount Gerizim instead of in Jerusalem. He sets up two places for them to do that kind of stuff. One's at Bethel and one's at Dan. So you've got that going on as well. And I got nearly ripped out. Here comes Novell. I think he's going to do what he did last week at this time and say, I've got to quit. So I'll tell Josh we got to chapter 13, if you don't tell him any different.